yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, this is the day, isn't it? The Donald becomes the president. What shall we see? Well, I'll bet you things you don't expect over the next 4 years, or maybe less. Let's look at the picture, the scenario, as he comes into office. What's the main news of the past week? Well, a number of potential major developments that will impact this presidency as he goes forward here with his policies. We'll talk about those policies a little bit, and we're going to continue talking about those a lot. Next week, we're going to dive deep into the healthcare issue and the imminent repeal of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and what that's going to look like. The debates are already in motion in Congress. That's their number one target. And alongside that will be corporate tax cuts. And then we'll see a flurry of other forms of deregulation, including gutting the Bank Regulation Act called Dodd-Frank, which was already a joke, but there were residues of financial regulation still hanging around in that act, and they're going to pick those off. And they especially don't like the Consumer Protection Agency. They're going to go after that. So we're going to see in the next 6 months, the honeymoon period, some very aggressive moves as far as corporate tax cuts, deregulation, Obamacare. We're not going to see an imminent attack on free trade and NAFTA. No, no, no. What you're going to get there is this one-off kind of high visibility, let's talk about the company X, company Y, you know, Z, and sort of, and we're going to get good publicity that way, Trump, that we're going to roll it back, and they're going to announce these companies some sort of accommodation to us. But we're not going to go wholesale after NAFTA and these free trade agreements yet. That's going to be on a back burner, you see. Because why? Because the corporate elite do not want him to touch that. It's okay, you know, we'll take these things one-on-one, which is really tokenism, doesn't really change anything. And we'll get big publicity out of that. You can get publicity, Mr. Trump, but don't mess with the fundamental treaties. And, you know, Trump is not opposed to that. People think Trump is against NAFTA and free trade. No, 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 he's not. He's against multilateral free trade agreements because he thinks, in his big ego, that he can do better one-on-one, bilateral free trade. That's what you're going to see. You're going to see one-on-one renegotiation, but it will be free trade nonetheless, and it will have the effects nonetheless, but we'll keep up this ideological barrage here of attacking individual companies and getting them to back off. And there's even this comical thing going on right now where companies are rushing to announce, even before he focuses, and maybe on them, they're terrified that, oh, he's going to pick on them individually in the news and so forth. And they're already announcing, oh, we're going to bring jobs back. You know, these are announcements. They don't mean anything. They're not going to bring these jobs back. You know, but they're talking it up, you see, and make people think that they're going to do something. And please, Mr. Trump, go focus your free trade flashlight on somebody else here. Don't attack us, right? All the car companies are doing that right now, especially the foreign car companies, Japanese and so forth. Okay, so let's keep that in mind. Free trade by another name, bilateral free trade, but not up front, you see. I mean, up front, the elites, what they want is these big corporate tax cuts coming, and I'm talking about trillions of dollars that are right on the edge coming, you know, as if they needed more tax cuts. I mean, God, we've given them over $10 trillion, investors, wealthy, 1%. You know, watch that. I'll be following that. Oh, they're going to try to get rid of the inheritance tax altogether. They're going to cut the corporate tax probably to 15%. Right there, they're going to reduce the personal income tax top brackets, you know, and a whole host of other tax cuts for investors, wealthy, and corporations are coming. How are they going to pay for them? Well, you know, the Ryan boys in Congress, they want to pay for it by cutting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Yeah, that's what they're going to go after. But, you know, they're also going to change some taxes, I believe, on the middle class. You know, they're talking about getting rid of the mortgage and state income tax deductions. Whoa, that's a biggie. Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens here. We'll all follow that. It's a little too early to tell the outlines of the attack on ACA and the attack on Dodd-Frank financial regulation and corporate taxes being cut. But the mosaic will take shape here in the coming weeks, and we'll start talking about it as they do. Right? As it does. And it should be very interesting. And, you know, we'll hear the Democrats wail and rail, but they're totally toothless. You know? That's one of the great legacies of the Obama years, the destruction of the Democratic Party as a viable force of resistance. Yes, there'll be a lot of talk. You know, we'll look at these nominations, you know. A lot of talk. They can't do anything about these nominations. He's going to get whatever he wants. Maybe the Republicans will sink one of them in order to make it look like, you know, they didn't ram through every nomination. And by the way, nominations of whom? Nothing but billionaires and generals. That's what Trump is all about, is billionaires and generals. Okay. We'll talk a little bit more about the Trump legacy, Trump in historical perspective. You know, what does he represent? He's not as radically new as people think. The origins of Trump go back even as far as Nixon and elements of Reagan and Clinton. Yes, this is a continuation here. This is not a radical break. Okay, what were the key events of the past week to keep an eye on of great import? Well, okay, there's a number of them. The president of China, Xi, right, warns of a trade war coming. Yes, Trump is trying to signal that a trade war is possible. He's going to go to the edge with that. But he's not going to really allow a trade war to come. But this is all bargaining stuff that he's playing. You know, he's a wheeler, dealer, real estate guru, tycoon. And he believes in his great ego that he can do better negotiating. He thinks he is, the number one negotiator in the world. So he wants to get a crack at all these deals. He wants to renegotiate them. Well, he wants to renegotiate the relationship with China, particularly on the trade front. You know, we run a $350 billion a year trade deficit with China, and he wants to rearrange that. You know, all the other countries that we run trade deficits with, next in line, you know, would be Mexico and Germany. About $50 billion a year, okay? So, whoa, China's a whopper, right? And and he wants to be able to renegotiate that. And also, I believe that the elites are turning to China because they really want China now to do something about North Korea. And watch the cards that Trump plays as he puts pressure on China. One of the big cards is the threat and maybe even the beginning of allowing Japan to militarily rearm. Japan desperately needs to do that, you see. Japan can't get its economy going. It's got a little respite here as the dollar rises. As interest rates rise, the U.S. dollar rises, the yen is falling, so they're getting a little export bump. Japan is in a 20-year funk economically and can't get out of it, and all the things they've tried, including the most aggressive quantitative easing program. They were the first to introduce QE, and now they got this QQE. And given the size of their economy, they are pumping more liquidity, buying up not only government bonds, which is pretty much all bought up already, but buying up corporate bonds, and not even buying up all just corporate bonds, but buying up stock. And they got the government pension system and other government agencies buying up stock. Keep that Japanese stock market up there, because that's where people make money. The wealthy make money. You can't allow that to fall. So they are becoming the biggest buyer demand for Japanese stock market offerings of any source. All this QE across the world is really to protect the capital gains of the 1%, you see. If you've got a slow economy and performances are not so great by corporations, well, their stock's going to fall. Well, how do you offset that? Well, you get the central banks in there, and you get them to buy up this stuff. Increase the demand, increases the price. Stock market, keep that stock market from falling by massive government purchases of stock in Japan. We're not doing that yet in the U.S., but we would be prepared to do that. They're doing it in Europe. Well, buying corporate bonds, but not corporate stock. But that's there on the agenda if necessary. Keep up those financial asset markets. Keep them going. While we have this slow growth. Well, it's a indication of crisis of global capitalism in the 21st century. They can't generate the growth that corporations on their own. So the governments and their central bank wings step in and prop them up. They're becoming dependent on central bank. They're addicted to central bank monetary liquidity injections to keep their financial asset markets going. And that's the big story since the beginning of the 21st century, pretty much. Okay, so Xi warns trade war, and watch what they're doing in terms of purchasing U.S. treasuries, declining fast. Right, that's the card the Chinese have to make. On their side, this tit for tat confrontation coming, economically and politically, as finally the U.S. elites turn to China. Now, Obama had talked about pivot to China, but couldn't do it. Why? Well, you got to get out of the Middle East. Right? And you got to do something about these dumbass neocons who want to, reignite the Cold War with Russia and have been pushing NATO into Eastern Europe and the Balkans, and the Baltics, right? And in the Ukraine, that phony coup in the Ukraine, which, by the way, the Bidens, Joe Biden and his family, were making money off of, The neocons got the U.S. into a morass. Big asses and get us into morasses. Yes. They wanted to have a ground war in Syria. Well, that was just going too far for Obama. And of course, Hillary was going to do that. You know, Hillary's talking during the campaign of, you know, what we need to do is no fly zone, shoot down some Russian planes, right? Yeah. Well, she is knee deep in the neocons, you know, particularly, you know, Virginia Nuland, who's a real neocon, and her husband there is a real neocon, drove the whole policy with this Ukraine coup a couple years back. And then she got herself appointed as the Minister of Economics in the Ukraine. Yeah, she was a private equity leader, Horizon Capital, out of Chicago, right? That was her business. Well, she's been making big money ever since she got herself appointed as a Ukrainian national. You know, the Ukraine government suspended its own laws about having foreigners assume top positions in the government. Well, and they appointed her. And they appointed this other big capitalist from Germany, or actually I think he was from Lithuania or Latvia or something, right? But he worked for German finance institutions for some time, and they appointed him. And two of them, Virginia Nuland and this other guy, he had a long name, I forget what it was, were running Ukraine. Well, Ukraine's still a basket case, right? And the Europeans, Western Europeans, don't even want anything to do with it because it's just a big drain. Well, anyway, Obama could not extricate himself. The neocons were slowly pushing step by step, you know, with Russian sanctions and everything, and Ukraine, and putting U.S. Military units in Estonia and Latvia and places like that, really dumb. And the Russians were responding by putting, you know, nuclear short-range missiles up on the border. Really a dumb move. Well, you know, the elites in the U.S. Say, whoa, wait a minute. You know, is this really in our interest here? You know, the Trump wing, you know, to get further embroiled in that mess in Syria and trying to reignite a Cold War in Eastern Europe. Come on, our real threat is China and this growing alliance between China and Russia, this deepening economic relationship, which has been growing very deep here in recent years. Russia providing oil and food and all kinds of technology to China. And growing coordination militarily and, you know, in their navies and other military forces. Well, what you've got here is finally elite saying, well, that's our big threat. It's over in Asia. And we got to hurry up and make this pivot to Asia that Obama couldn't make. Right. That's really what's behind a lot of this Trump courting of Russia, right? Trump is trying to neutralize this whole wasteful targeting of Russia, and he's trying to do what Nixon did back in the 1970s. What Nixon did was cut a deal with China to increase the pressure on Russia, and of course Reagan picked that up and ran with that in the early 1980s. But that was Nixon's policy, you see. Well, Trump is just inverting it. You know, what Trump is doing is wants to cut a deal with Russia in the Middle East and Eastern Europe so that he could go put pressure on China, because China is the greater challenge for U.S. economic elites right now. Okay, so we're going to have signals of, oh, we'll have a trade war and China will, you know, reduce purchase of treasuries. Part of the reason why it's doing that, China is also, it has to keep propping up its currency. You see, it agreed with the IMF to make the Chinese currency a reserve currency, which means it had to keep it stable. But there's a lot of pressure for capital flight out of China. The wealthy in China want to move their money out. And that capital flight has the effect of depressing its currency, the yuan. Well, you know, if China has struck this deal with global capitalists that we're going to keep our currency stable, capital flight is a problem because it depresses the currency. How does it do that? Well, if you want to take your money out of China, if you're a rich China capitalist, what you got to do is take your currency and you got to buy other currencies, whether U.S. dollar or the euro or the pound or the Australian dollar or whatever. You got to buy it. You got to take your currency and buy it. Well, when you dump your currency on the market like that, it declines. The currency devalues, you see. And you devalue your currency, well, that gives you an export advantage. And then you run up against Trump and friends and say, well, you got too much of an export advantage already. $350 billion in trade deficit with you, And China's trying to comply. China's trying to keep its currency from devaluing. If it really wanted to manipulate its currency, it would just let it happen. The real currency manipulators are the Japanese. But the U.S. doesn't say anything about that, about the Japanese depressing the yen and getting a trade advantage with the U.S., because they're really an economic satrapy of the United States and have been since 1945. Okay. All right, so... U.S. doesn't say anything about the pound being devalued, does it? Or the euro being devalued? No, it's the Chinese. Well, the Chinese yuan has not been devalued anywhere near as much as those other currencies. But yet we hear, China is a currency manipulator. All right, so what we got is an imminent trade war, but it's all tactical by Trump, you see. It's all tactical because Trump wants to negotiate a new deal, and then he'll come back waving, the piece of paper, say, "Look what I did! Look what I did! I'm a great negotiator," right? And that's where his ego is. That's what he believes he is, and that's what he wants to do. That's how he's going to prove he's a great president. At least he thinks so, right? If he gets to continue for 4 years, I don't think the elite. If he doesn't. The elite won't let him finish 4 years, I don't believe. Okay, so that's the number one thing, a number one thing that's happened this past week. Xi went before Davos, the Davos Forum where all the super rich in the world gather and listen to, some of the funky entertainers and talk and mix with each other and share views and so forth, right? And really meet in backroom deals and cut deals about where they're all going to go next, okay? Kind of like a Las Vegas, You go to Las Vegas and they got all these sideshows going on, entertainment and so on and so forth, but the real money's at the crap tables and at the baccarat tables. All right. So what else is important this past week? Well, the European Central Bank signaled a QE monetary policy shift, right? One of the big quantitative easing, in other words, central bank buying up of bonds and injecting liquidity money into the system, driving down interest rates in the hope that lower interest rates would stimulate investment in the real economy. Look, economically, lowering interest rates does not necessarily stimulate the economy. What do you do when you lower interest rates? Well, you reduce the cost for business, right? A cost for business. The cost of money to expand. But if there isn't good opportunities to expand, if people have money to buy the things, then you're not going to invest. In other words, profitability and investment is not driven by the cost of investment alone. It's expectations of profits that drive investment. Well, look at what's going on, since Trump. Everyone thinks there's big infrastructure spending coming. Oh, profits. Now they're loosening up their wallets a little. We'll see how much. Economists call that animal spirits, animal spirits of investors. Their animal spirits are rising a little bit again. But it doesn't have anything to do with reducing interest rates. Look, we had zero or less interest rates for 8 years, and we had the lowest investment in real assets, building, machinery, equipment, in over half a century. Lowering costs do not stimulate investment. Oh, but listen, lowering costs by deregulation is supposed to stimulate investment, right? No, it doesn't have anything different in terms of effect than lowering interest rates. They're both reducing costs. Reducing costs, corporate costs, do not necessarily result in increasing investment. Oh, what about tax cuts? Oh, it's all you hear. Tax cuts will create jobs. I mean, tax cuts will stimulate investment and businesses will hire, right? Will create jobs. Same argument. Reducing corporate costs will stimulate investment. Look, this is neoclassical 101, neoclassical economics 101, and it's false across the board. But it's ideology, you know, and you pump enough of this nonsense into people's heads through the media, they began to believe, oh, tax cuts create jobs. Even those dummies in Congress believe that, many of them. Tax, because they want to believe it. Why? Because their friends are businesses, and their business friends fund their campaign. So people believe what they want to believe if it's in their interest, even though it's false. So tax cuts create jobs. Big ideological lie. Lower interest rates create jobs. Same lie. Deregulation reduces business costs and will create jobs. Third version of the same lie. This is all economic ideology. In other words, you falsify the truth and you get people to believe it. And, oh, it sounds logically correct, but the real world is not logical. You know, economists like to show, oh, reduce costs, oh, business have more money, therefore, ipso facto, we assume they'll take that more money and they will invest that more money. You know, this goes all the way back to Adam Smith. Well, it's nonsense. The real world doesn't act that way. You give corporations more discretionary income, money, retain their profits and whatever. What are they going to do with it? The assumption is they're going to invest it in real assets. In other words, plant, equipment, construction, buildings, housing, etc., right? Well, no, they may just sit on it, you see. They may just hoard it if they think that investing is not going to bring sufficient profits. Or they may take it and send it to some part of the world where there is greater profitability. Or they may just take it and put it into financial assets. Let's plunk it into the stock market. Let's plunk it into the bond market, you know, the junk bond market. Let's play some derivatives, right? Let's speculate with currency, foreign exchange currency fluctuations. We can make bigger profits there faster. Why should we invest it in mom and pop business, so we don't know, because no one's buying their stuff if they're going to be around in 10 years. When we can push it into these financial asset markets and in 3 months, 6 months, turn a nice profit even bigger. See, this is a big shift going on in global capitalism. What I call my book, The Financial Investment Shift, Financial Asset Investing Shift. And the central banks keep pumping money into the system in the assumption that some of it will trickle down, a little bit will trickle down. Yeah, most of it they know, and they've been writing about this now, they know that most of this QE and this money injection is going to go into financial assets to keep capital gains up, and that's what the central banks are all about. They are servants to the private banking system. That's why they were created, to do that. Well, I got a new book coming out in April called Central Bankers on the Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Next Depression by Clarity Press. I've already talked about this in my 2016 book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, also by Clarity Press. You can get reviews of this. Just go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, which will take you to my website. You know, just click on the icon, take you to my website, where you can read reviews about this as well on my website, Kikos Productions. Okay. So I'll be extending this. But we got this ECB policy shift that just occurred this past week, you know. Already, the European Central Bank has injected $2.5 trillion through QE into the European economy, has driven interest rates for a while there below zero, negative interest rates. And the whole idea was to, you know, some of it will trickle down into investing in real assets instead of financial speculation. But it hasn't happened, right? Doesn't work, because once again, simply lowering costs does not work. Well, the whole idea with negative interest rates was force companies to invest because they're going to have to pay the central bank, bankers and central banks, just to hold their cash, you see, rather than pay for holding your cash safely somewhere, go invest it. Well, that didn't work either, you see. Well, $80 billion a month in QE purchases by the ECB. Now, last week, the ECB announced it would reduce it to $60 billion, but continue it for another 9 months, right? The Germans are opposed to that. The German conservative bankers are opposed to that. And they're saying, well, you know, U.S. interest rates are rising because the dollar is rising, and the dollar is rising, so the euro is already depreciating. And we don't need QE to drive down the value of the euro, because the U.S., by raising the value of dollar, is also, in effect, driving down euro. And that will stimulate exports, you see, because that's another objective. Another argument, false argument of QE, right? Not only that reducing the costs will stimulate real investment, but by pumping money into the economy, liquidity injections, QE liquidity injections, what you're going to do is lower the value of your currency, and that will give you a competitive advantage in terms of export sales, and that will stimulate the economy. Well, neither of the approaches to stimulate the economy actually work in reality, right? And the Germans are saying, you know, the German bankers, I should say, are saying, well, we already got depressing value of the euro. You know, it was $1.45 a few years ago. Now it's $1.05 to the dollar. And the same thing with the British pound, you know, with $1.50 at one point there, you know, now it's $1.20. So, you know, who's driving down their currency by QE and other measures? You know, in the Bank of England, the Brits are doing QE, too, and not only buying government bonds to inject money, but buying corporate bonds. Both the ECB and the Bank of England are buying corporation bonds, subsidizing the value of bonds and bond issuers, corporate bond issuers, you see, keep the interest rates low. They're the ones who are manipulating their currencies. Well, you know, it goes from $1.45.50 to $1.05, $1.20, right? That's like a 20-something percent devaluation of the currencies. How much have the Chinese devalued their currencies? Well, they keep it within a band in relationship to the dollar, so maybe 5%, maybe, you know, 5, 6% at the most. You know, they keep it in a band of 6.2 to 6.9 yuan to the dollar. Who's the big manipulators? And same thing you could say about Japan. They're doing the same thing. But you don't hear anything about that, right? Okay. So the Germans are saying the ECB, this isn't working. You don't need to do this. We should stop pumping this money into the economy because it's going to cause inflation. Well, they're wrong on that latter point, too. I mean, how much money do you have to pump into the economy to show that you're not getting inflation in real goods and services? You're getting inflation in financial assets because that's where the money's going, but you're not getting it in goods and services. You know, they got a problem with consumer prices, producer prices in these countries, you know, barely 1% growing despite tens of trillions of dollars, you know, injected by central banks, right? But why is the ECB signal it's going to continue this for another 9 months, even if it's at a slightly reduced rate? Right. Well, because politics has entered the global economy equation with a vengeance this past year. You see, Brexit, right? Brexit, Italian vote, going to be the big variable in where the global economy goes this year. And that's why the ECB is continuing this. They want to continue this because they don't know how destabilizing the political elections in Europe coming up are going to be. The big one, of course, is France in April, May. You know, will the Trump-like National Front movement win the elections in France? If they do, they will call for a Frexit. And boy, you don't think that's going to destabilize the European economy. It's going to accelerate the entropy forces there already at work. Okay. And as the crisis continues, you know, the southern periphery economies are resisting because part of this QE, let's give all the power for the direction of the economy to central banks and monetary policy, which has been the case since 2008, you know, part of this is that putting lids on fiscal spending. That's part of the deal, you see. Because the elites know that this approach through monetary policy and QE, which is give all the money to the finance and banking people, and maybe some of it will trickle down, financial trickle down, means slow growth. Quick recovery for financial investors, but slow recovery for the rest of us. Slow recovery means deficits will rise as economic activity near stagnates. So to keep the deficits from rising further, we put a lid on fiscal spending. See, that's how fiscal austerity relates to this QE monetary thing. A QE monetary, central bank, financial elites are driving everything. They drove us into the crisis, and they're driving the post-crisis recovery strategy, and that's why it's been so weak and so poor. Well, here comes Trump, and he says, we're going to make a real turn to fiscal infrastructure spending. But it's interesting to see how the pushback is beginning to Trump and whole infrastructure fiscal spending is beginning to evolve. The central bank in the U.S., the Federal Reserve, you know, Janet Yellen, has come out now a couple times and said, the economy is running too hot. You know, we can't have fiscal spending. We have to just stay with the central bank, my shop, running the show. And we'll see how much the elites and the Paul Ryans and everything can turn infrastructure spending, fiscal stimulus, Trump, into just a tax cut, Trump, and a token long-term infrastructure spending. It won't really create jobs. In fact, it may destroy jobs, right? It may be a boon for businesses to get low-cost subsidies to replace workers with new automated equipment. That's what might come out of this. Big tax cuts, more automation, less jobs, less high-paying good jobs, manufacturing and so forth, right? You know, more gig jobs, more low-paid service jobs. This is where the working class is being driven in the U.S. and globally, to this part-time, contingent, low-paid, no benefits. Work two jobs, work three jobs, right, instead of decent jobs. And that's what the revolt was about, in part, that put him in office. Him, Trump, right? Okay, another important event, the United Kingdom signals, hard Brexit. In other words, we're not going to continue dithering here in negotiations of how we're going to negotiate, right? We had a referendum, and we're going to have a Brexit. Britain's going to leave, the European Union. And in other words, it could come sooner rather than later. You see, the elites over there did not want this. And their whole strategy ever since the vote was to delay. You know, delay and hope that the economic dislocations that followed the announcement would change public opinion. Then we'll go have another vote, you see. And turn everything around. It's like union negotiations, you know. If the union leadership and the company don't like the outcome of a rejection of a contract, they just put it to another vote, right? They wait for a better opportunity and they put it to another vote. And they keep putting it to vote till they get the result they want. You know, that was the whole corporate business strategy over there. But now, you know, the conservatives who are in the hands now of the Trump-like Brexiters are pushing back and saying, well, no, we've got to do this quickly. And that's upset people this past week. Well, why are they doing this? Because they think, and they possibly do, have a informal agreement with Trump to increase trade between the U.S. Trump and the Brexiters are closely allied and have been talking with each other and sending people back and forth, right? So Trump is saying, well, you know, forget it. We'll have a special deal with you. Don't worry about it, right? And that's bolstered the Brexiters over there. And also, the decision is by the Brexiters to make the UK a center leading center of tax reduction. They're going to try to keep their banks and locate businesses to the UK by offering them the lowest possible taxes. Right. They're going to turn the UK into a Hong Kong. Right. And that will set off a corporate tax cut race to the bottom globally. So that's why the Brexiters feel a little emboldened here, right? That they're going to be able to pull this off. All right, another event of the past week was this, all these nominees here, Trump cabinet nominees, you know, step and fetch it shuffle going on here. These people come before these committees. It's a circus. It's a show. It's not real. And they say whatever they got to say to get nominated. They don't believe this stuff that they're saying, you know. It's such a joke. And the Democrats, you know, are making a deal of this, and they have no muscle anymore. It's a show, right? The billionaires and the generals are all going to get appointed. And what a show it is. You know, there's Betsy DeVos, education secretary, right, who wants to privatize public education, turn it into charter school system, right? You see big advances there. I couldn't believe it. They were talking, the senator from Connecticut said, what about the education, you know, and guns in schools? You know, 20 little kids got gunned down because nutcases can get machine guns whenever they want. Okay, and he asked her about that, and she hesitated. Oh, guns are okay in school. It's okay to carry guns to school. And she was asked, well, why? Oh, there might, like in Wyoming, there might be grizzly bears. You got to protect yourself against grizzly bears. Can you believe that? We got to have guns because there's grizzly bears? Boy, the depth of stupidity of some of these people. And the ability to maneuver politically. And then there's Steve Mnuchin, you know, who's going to be the powerful Secretary of the Treasury, right? Who is a big foreclosure king. You know, he buys up, IndyMac? I forget what bank that went under. And foreclosed all the homes, you know. But he comes out and, you know, he says, no, I wasn't a foreclosure king. I was a refi hero, refinance. I refinanced all these people. Well, how many did you foreclose and how many did you refi, Steve? Well, no one on the Democrats on these committees asked him that number, you know. And, of course, the media just runs with his rebuttal. Makes him look like, oh, he was a hero. No. Not a schmuck. All right, so I'm not going to talk anymore about those clowns and the cabinet clowns doing their step-and-fetch-it shuffle. Uncle Tom's. Billionaire Uncle Tom's. Okay, What else happened? Indonesia slapped down Chase Bank and U.S. bank rating agencies that had downgraded them, the country's bonds and so forth. So Indonesia says, okay, get out of town, Chase. It's an indication of the growing independence of these Asian nations, Philippines, you know. Philippines President Duterte, you know, he just keeps bad-mouthing the U.S. and signing deals with China, right? And now Indonesia is leaning in that direction. That's why they got to pay more attention to Asia, and they're going to, right? As I said, Trump will give signals he's going to allow Japan to rearm, which is what Shinzo Abe wants, because it's that kind of fiscal spending that might give a little boost to his economy, because everything else hasn't. By the way, infrastructure spending did not do much either for Japan. Japan's been doing infrastructure spending, massive, you know, for 10 years, but these kind of long-term, low labor-intensive projects don't generate much. Keep a watch on that, you know, when we see this infrastructure spending. Okay, so more effort focusing on South Korea, as I said. Efforts to deepen relationships with Vietnam economically. You know, the U.S. is going to pay more attention here because, you know, places like Indonesia and Philippines are signaling red, right? Okay. What else? Last week, U.S. banks announced big profits. More to come as interest rates and dollar continues to rise. And we're already beginning to see effect of this on housing, rising rates, which haven't hardly begun to rise, but mortgage applications have plummeted. They're falling through the floor. You know, going to be a real recession here in housing coming. Autos have peaked. Yeah, they had a good Christmas. Well, that's because they're all giving big discounts, you see. Autos, but autos cannot go higher. Autos will go lower. Two big important areas of the U.S. economy. Consumption spending will take a hit, too, because the cost of debt is going to rise for general households. And that's where most of the consumption's been coming from borrowing money, not from income gains, but from borrowing money. Income gains, wage gains has been concentrated on, you know, the upper 10% of the wage structure. Not at the middle, and certainly not below, although you get a little boost because of some states raising minimum wages. Okay, so big bank profits announced. Well, look at the bankers, especially the shadow bankers, you know, people in Trump's cabinet, you know, from hedge funds and private equity firms and so forth, asset management companies, you know. It's not your traditional bankers. It's these wheeler dealer hedge fund guys and equity guys and so forth. And now those are the people that you know, Trump is used to fund his empire, so he knows them well. But these are big risk takers, you see, and willing to risk a boom, willing to risk a bust to go after a boom, right? All right, Yellen. Janet Yellen, as I said, pushing back on fiscal stimulus, as all the central bankers do. They want to stay in the catbird seat. They want to run general economic policy. Okay, what else? Important news, hottest year on record, 2016. Third year in a row, as Trump's EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, will be put into cold storage. Hottest year, yeah. We may reach that tipping point earlier and faster, and no return. You know, the capitalists will figure out some way to sell us stuff to keep us from boiling. You know, it's a good investment opportunity here to have an environmental crisis. Now, the important thing I noticed, too, is that I want to finish on here is warnings from the U.S. elite to Trump. You know, I've been arguing that they're going to eventually tame Trump. Here. You know, I wrote a piece called Taming Trump here. It's on my blog, jackrasmus.com, where I predicted that the elites of both parties, you know, both wings of the one party called the Corporate Party of America. We sometimes call them Democrats and Republicans, but you know, they're all part of the neoliberal offensive here. Have been shocked by Trump's rhetoric and his base of support, you know, in the middle class, including the white working class, but small businesses and so on. You know, the Alliance of Small Business and Midwest working class types that Trump has put together here, along with his more aggressive finance and other capitalist allies. That's the new coalition, you see. And it's not unlike Nixon's coalition. They call it the silent majority. Well, you know, that's the working class, the small business, and rural people in rural. You know, you look at the U.S., what do you got? Democrats are in these enclaves now, you know, the Northeast from New York City to Boston, right, up over there, and the West Coast. You know, the rest is all Trump land in between. Great legacy, Obama. Okay, and by the way, I wrote a piece on the audacity of Obama's farewell speech, where I debunked some of his claims of a great legacy he's leaving us, you know. Well, he's not leaving us. He's going to inject himself into politics here, even after he's staying in Washington, bought a house. He's going to be talking it up, you see. And the media, the elite media, is going to use him. And he's going to use them. You know, elite media, I mean, I talk about New York Times and Washington Post and all those outlets of the traditional U.S. business elite, which hasn't really accepted him. You see, there's this kind of Tim Trump. There's kind of a status quo, or, you know, live and let live. We'll see how this works out. Relationship, they opposed him all the way, right, because he threatened, at least in terms of talk, to upset a lot of their foreign policy and trade and other relationships. But they're tolerating him because what they want out of him, and they sense the opportunity to get these big tax cuts and get deregulation, right, and get Obamacare off their tax back. Obamacare taxes, you see, that's what the elite, why they don't like, you know, this 3.8 surtax that was part of the funding of ACA. They've never liked that. They don't like the investment, 0.8 investment tax, and that's why they've opposed it, and they've manipulated and, you know, middle-class types who oppose it with good reason. You know, middle class didn't really benefit from this. Warnings from the elite to Trump are coming out. Well, they have been coming out for some time, and as I predicted, the elite will tolerate him in order to quick honeymoon period, get these tax cuts, deregulation, and so forth pushed through. And then you know, they're trying to get him to hold off doing anything on other fronts, particularly trade, which I think he will hold off on. You know, his strategy is going to be talk up these individual cases, you know. And they're going to let him do the non-economic stuff, you know, immigration, build a wall, roll back civil liberties, you know, release the police, law and order forces, and so forth to attack protesters and et cetera. They don't care about that. That's not money for them. You know, trade is money. NAFTA is money. Tax cuts are money. You That's what they want. And they'll let him do this non-economics, him, Trump, non-economic stuff here, you know, as long as he doesn't provoke too much opposition, while they get the tax cuts pushed through, you see? And they're telling him, yeah, we want privatization too, and he's on the same same track as them. You know, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac are going to be privatized. Student loan debt will be re-privatized. Charter schools and other forms of privatization will occur, because this is all part of neoliberalism 2.0, which is what he, Trump, is all about. Obama couldn't put together Humpty Dumpty neoliberalism 1.0 that crashed in 2008-9. Couldn't put it back together, so now we got Neo 2.0 coming. Hmm? And the elites are also saying, hey, go slow. Go slow on this foreign policy stuff, particularly NATO, right, and China, and, you know, don't do anything rash. There was a recent editorial by Richard Haass from the Council of Foreign Relations, you know, entitled, I think it was yesterday in the Wall Street Journal, don't make any sudden moves, Mr. Trump. He makes them nervous. He doesn't. They don't want him to go too fast. And Haass talks about we have to apply stare decisis to foreign policy. In other words, Latin term for let it stay, let it stand. Stare decisis. And there was no sudden or sharp departures, please. Right? You're going to make things worse. You know. Don't abandon this China One policy deal too quickly, because you're going to aggravate the Chinese in our trade relations. Well, that's exactly what Trump wants to do, because he wants to put some pressure on them, throw some, you know, something new in the equation, and renegotiate, right? And Haass is saying, oh, we could lead. Don't upset the Iran deal, because it will piss off our allies, and nuclear proliferation, and don't move the U.S. embassy because to Jerusalem, because that will piss off other allies and so forth. Be very careful, and they're giving him these signals, and we'll see whether he abides by them once he gets into office. I predict long-term he will, right? I predict this is neoliberalism 2.0 coming, you know? It's variations on the theme, and this theme goes back to Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan. And next week we'll talk about what's coming post inaugural address. That address will be interesting. Listen to it tonight. All right, this is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. See you next week.